So good evening, everyone. What we're going to be doing, or what I am going to be offering, or I and my dear friend James Perez are going to be offering for the next 6 weeks, is a series called Awakening Joy. This is a book by James Perez. The title is Awakening Joy, 10 Steps to Happiness. And actually, James Perez wrote me a letter, or sent me a letter this morning, that he asked me to read to all of you. So, dear Seattle Insight Meditation Community, it gives me great pleasure to know that Bonnie is offering you this series on Awakening Joy. Seeing Dharma practice as a path of happiness is something that can often be missed, even though the Buddha was called the happy one, and he recommended going for the highest happiness. I myself, at one point in my Dharma journey, became dead serious about my practice, emphasis on dead, and lost my joy. When I realized what had happened, I became motivated to explore just what the Buddha said about true happiness, and found a richness of teachings that not only encouraged happiness, but pointed to very effective ways to bring that about. I hope in going through this series with Bonnie that you not only take in the concepts, but actually practice them over these weeks. As one of my teachers, the wonderful Poonjaji, used to say, reading the menu is different from actually tasting the food. He's wagging his finger. About 15 years ago, I tried out these principles with my Berkeley group in a series similar to what Bonnie is presenting. As we all supported each other in practicing them together over a two-month period, most everyone agreed the increased level of general well-being was striking. That was what motivated me to continue to teach and write about them. I hope something similar happens to you and your community if you choose to engage in these practices. May you enjoy the series, be happy, and share your love well in this world. With metta and mudita, James. So he also asked me, he said, would it be okay with you if I listened to your series? And I said, absolutely, because he's quite a gentle teacher. So I would like us all right now to just reflect on, you know, how he's with us now and offer him some gratitude, because gratitude actually feels really good. So how about a thank you, James, on the tape, because he will hear that. Okay. Thank you, James. We appreciate you. I'm reflecting right now on your generosity. So Iris asked that I introduce myself, and I will do that. So I actually want to tell you about my introduction to this practice, to this Dharma practice. Because people often ask, well, how come, you know, why are you sitting up there? And it's a pretty interesting thing about why I'm sitting up here. So I'd like to share that briefly with you. So I started college at San Francisco State University in 1973. I know it sounds like it's going way back, but hang in there with me. You know, I went to college under a special admissions program because, you know, I'm a first generation college student. My family was pretty poor, mixed race people in the middle of San Francisco. And, you know, in that, I want to say, any of you I know of a certain age who had anything to do with the civil rights movement and the women's movement, I just want to bow to you right now. Because it's because of you that I actually got to go to college. So I want to thank you for that right now. And I want you to reflect on, you know, what even that one march you went to or that one petition that you signed, I want you to reflect on the impact that that had. So rejoice in your own goodness for a minute. So anyway, I went to undergraduate school, and When I got out, you know, all my dear, wonderful, middle-class white friends, you know, what did you do after you go to college? You went to Europe for the summer, right? And I had no money to go to Europe, but all my friends were going, so I bought a one-way ticket, and I moved to Germany, and I worked in a ski resort. And I met all these wonderful expatriates, and they were all saying, go to Asia, you have to go to Asia. So I decided I was going to do that. I lived in Europe for about 5 or 6 years, traveled around a lot and had a lot of partying. It was fun and extended adolescence. And then they said, because Asia is so different, you should check yourself into a monastery when you go there. So from Germany, from the, you know, German Alps, I flew into Kathmandu, Nepal. And I checked myself into a Tibetan Buddhist monastery about 20 miles out of Kathmandu called Kopan Monastery. Has anybody been there?
Yeah.
Yeah, Kopan. Oh my God. I know. This was in 1982. And so anyway, you know, I'm a native mixed race by ancestry. I worked, you know, for my whole life in American Indian, Alaska Native communities. And when I saw the Tibetans, man, I thought I had come home. And what I learned there just seemed incredibly true to me. So from there, I spent like 2 months in the monastery, just taking class after class, living there. And from there, I went to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha became enlightened. A lot of people were going there because back in those days, I don't know if he still does it, but His Holiness the Dalai Lama teaches for a whole month in Bodh Gaya. Does he still do that? I don't know. Does anybody know? He used to do that every January. So I went there and I did my first Vipassana course, this kind of meditation mindfulness, my very first course. So I traveled all around India for about a year. You know, I went up to Dharamsala, McLeod Ganj, and took some teachings in the Tibetan library. And I would walk around the hills of Dharamsala, you know, and His Holiness would be walking around with his entourage, and I would just run into him on the trails. It was an incredible time in 1982. So I stayed there for almost a year, and I came back to the San Francisco Bay Area. And so when I came back, you know, I just loved this practice. I was sitting like 5 or 6 hours a day and actually quite happy by it. And I came back, and this was like 1982, 83. And the very first meditation retreat I heard about was a weekend retreat in Pescadero taught by Jaime Berez. So I actually met, we used to call him Jamie, now his name is James. Remember that, Jamie? and that's the, you know, I wanted to tell you that just because, he was, you know, James was one of my first teachers here in the United States, and that was really meaningful for me. And, you know, I ended up actually, so that's to tell you how I met the Dharma. So I met the Dharma in 1982, and, you know, I just loved it so much. I heard it, I thought it was the truth. And every single vacation I had since that time, I would go into retreat. And then 1 year, I just happened to start sitting with Joseph Goldstein. And Joseph we just had some kismet, and, you know, they talk about a series of openings, and I just started sitting with him, and he started inviting me back to IMS to sit. And then actually James started something called the Community Dharma Leader Program, which some of us in here actually have gone through. I've gone through it. Chris is going to go through it. Who else has gone through the Community Dharma Leader? Terreri went through it. Oh yeah, Dennis Martinowicz went through it. That's right. And James actually started that. And then there's another level of teaching called retreat teaching, and you can't really even apply for that. Someone decides that you're going to be in the teacher training, and they invite you into the teacher training. And that's what happened to me. I was washing my car at Costco in January of 2011. listening to my voicemail on my phone, and it was Jack Kornfield, and I had never talked to him before in my life. But there's a 5-minute message on my phone saying, Joseph says that you should be in the teacher training, so clear your calendar for March and come up and start apprenticing for the March month long at Spirit Rock. And I did. And that wasn't easy to clear my calendar for a month, but so that's how I get to sit here, because I'm in the IMS Spirit Rock Teacher Training Program. So just wanted to give you that. And I am so delighted to be here. I love this Sangha with all my heart. Sim Sangha, we love it. And I'm so happy. So I was just apprenticing for 2 weeks. Part of this is we do a lot of apprenticing. And I was just at the last 2 months, I mean the 2 weeks of the February month long at Spirit Rock. You guys all know there's a February and March, there's a 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock just down the road. And I was apprenticing for the last 2 weeks in February and just hand-wringing. You know, James was one of the teachers there, and I said, what am I going to do for 2 weeks? And then I saw that he had just started a new series of Awakening Joy, and I thought, James, what about if I do Awakening Joy? And he was so generous. You know, we sat down for a couple hours and sketched out what the course might look like. And so that's what I'm offering to you tonight and for the next 6 weeks. It's actually an abbreviated version. He has 10 steps, and he actually does it in a 5-month period. We're going to do it in 6 weeks, so you're going to have a lot of homework. But, you know, I really do think it's beneficial, and I think, you know, it's very deeply rooted in the teachings of the Buddha. And I think sometimes we have misinterpreted what the Buddha taught about happiness. So I want to cover some of those details. First, a little quote here by Howard Zinn. The optimism of uncertainty. Human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And we know who Howard Zinn's son-in-law is, right? Jon Kabat-Zinn is Howard Zinn's son-in-law. Some people don't know that, but you know that, you know, Howard Zinn is kind of like a radical historian. So this course is actually going to be 6 weeks. Tonight I'm going to talk about some of the foundational Buddhist principles and an overview of the course. Next week I'm going to talk about intention and mindfulness, because it really all rests around mindfulness. Then I'm going to talk about the joy of integrity and letting go. And then self-compassion, loving ourselves and providing compassion to others. And then simply loving and simply being is the last course. And so James really recommends that if there's a way that we could actually check in with people during the 6 weeks. And I know many of you know each other, and you might have friends in the group. So you might consider even having a buddy or a couple people that you actually do some of these exercises with. Because you know what we're doing. The Buddha was the first neuropsychologist, right? He really understood about neuroplasticity. How did he know that? You know, it's amazing. You know, we just have had an fMRI for how long, where we saw the neuroplasticity of the human brain. And the Buddha, you know, in his Characteristics of the Brain, he talked about malleability 2,600 years ago. How did he know that? But anyway, you know, that's what we're doing here. We're really working with the malleability of the brain and the ability to dig new neural pathways towards more joy and more awareness of all of the positive in our life. And it's really helpful to do that really in the company of like-minded people. You know, that's one of the incredible benefits of Sangha, that, you know, we're doing this together and we all have a shared intention. So what are the principles of this Course Awakening Joy? There's three fundamental principles to it, and it's actually pretty brilliant when you think about it. It's pretty simple, but it really makes a lot of sense. So there's three fundamental principles. The first principle is that we are going to use our intention, our ability to direct the mind, and we are going to develop an intention towards inclining the mind towards joy. That's the first principle. The second principle is that one of the things that brings joy that we probably don't access enough is that the Buddha talked about, and this training talks about, positive, wholesome mental factors, mind states, and negative, unwholesome mental factors and mind states. And those are just based on whether they lead to happiness or whether they lead to suffering. That's the only judgment really involved with that. You know, whether it leads to happiness for others and ourselves, or whether the mental factors that we have in our mind that, you know, get played out in our actions and in our lives, whether they lead to suffering for others and ourselves. That's what wholesome and unwholesome is based on, really. Based on the actuality of what it produces. So the second principle, you know, the first one is inclining the mind, setting the intention. The second one is to develop wholesome mind states, as to continually to develop wholesome mind states. And you know what, and that leads to the third principle. And that is that when we have positive mental factors, positive mind states in our mind, it actually creates a mental uplift. It actually is what retrains those neural pathways. And that is what we should be paying attention to. So that's the third principle, is that when we have those positive states in our mind, or when through, you know, mindfulness externally, we see positive mental states in others, we take note of them. You know, we notice, wow, that person has joy in their mind. That person has generosity in their mind. That person has kindness and patience and forgiveness and tranquility. And when we notice that and when we savor that, that is what, you know, we do to incline the mind, and that's what we do to train the mind to be able to access these mental factors. What we're doing is we're watering the seeds of these very positive mental factors and making them much stronger in this, you know, combination of causes and conditions here. So we're watering the seeds of our positive mental factors, and we're noticing when unwholesome mental factors that lead to unhappiness for others and ourselves arise as well. And we, you know, make the intention to, you know, totally open to them because they're part of our experience too, but not necessarily act them out. And when we don't act them out, we actually, and when we see them with mindfulness, with awareness, you know, we actually extract the wisdom out of it. You know, we don't make a decision like, no, I don't want to have that. You know, what we're doing is we're extracting the wisdom just by watching it, by being aware, by seeing the, you know, really what it's doing to our mind and heart. And the wisdom lets go of it. We don't let go of it. We can't let go of it. You know, I know we probably have all said it to ourselves, I'm going to stop having greed, hatred, and delusion. How has that worked out for you? You know, our ego is not what lets go of all of that. It's wisdom that lets go of it. And that's where the mindfulness comes in. You know, I love the way that Rodney languages it. We have two knowledge systems. We have our rational, linear knowledge system. And, you know, I know about that. I'm actually a college professor at the University of Washington. So I got a lot of concepts. And then we have the knowledge system of our intuitive awareness. And I like to language that mindfulness is the data collection system for intuitive awareness. Because it sees things directly without conceptual overlay. It sees the true nature of all of our experience. And you know where I'm going with this, right? We see that it's changing all the time. You know, this is where mindfulness will really come in for us to really see how much happiness that we get from things that, you know, unfortunately our society kind of tells us that will bring us happiness, right? Things like accumulation and things like, you know, notoriety or fame or having a lot of money or things like that. You know, we can really see when those things come just how much stability and how much tranquility and peace of mind they offer. And then we also, you know, notice when generosity and kindness and the paramis are in our mind and see what that produces as well. It's really a beautiful thing. So the three principles of the course are, just to remind us, inclining the mind towards joy, and it's something that we will continue to do over and over again during the day. You know, that's part of the training. The second thing is to cultivate or be aware when positive mind states come into the mind, know when they're there, or essentially know what's in your mind and heart at any time. And then really make an effort to reflect and be take notice of and really just really extract the wisdom out of those positive and mental states. So that's the basic principles of the course. So these intentions in this system is really about deep reprogramming of our neural pathways. And it's very consistent with other, you know, I know many of you or some of you are psychotherapists or in psychology or in the helping professions. And this system is very consistent with what you would find in positive psychology. In fact, you know, the leaders of positive psychology right now are students of the founders of Western Theravada Buddhism. You know, they're students of Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and James Berets. So, you know, that's very consistent. There's a lot of evidence for that. So James offers a few things that we can do, supportive course practices that we can do during these 6 weeks that we are running through this material. And you know, you can, as you can imagine, they're what you would think they would be. The first one, of course, is to what? Meditate. What an idea. And, you know, he talks about, and, you know, we all talk about, I mean, all of the teachers will tell you that, you know, a daily practice, and this could be a time for us to kick in. Those of us who maybe have sloughed off our daily practice or, you know, do many moments of small mindfulness during the day, we can also take this as an opportunity to just even in the smallest way, assume the position at least once a day. You know, Joseph talks about that. He talks about just assume the position and see what happens. If you're there for 5 minutes, it's fine. If you're there for 45, how wonderful is that? Just to assume the position. So that's the first supportive thing in this course, in this course of awakening joy. The second thing I thought was kind of interesting that he's advising, and you know, this is all based in addition to the Buddha's teachings on, you know, positive psychology. The second that he really recommends, and he probably recommends this because he's actually a guitar player. Did he ever? Yeah, he's a guitar player. He loves to pull out his guitar and sing. But his recommendation is to sing. So, you know, during the day. And actually, there is some psychological research that, here, let me read this sweet little thing here. The physiological effects of singing are fairly well documented. For those who doubt its power, just look at songbirds. When male songbirds sing to female songbirds, it activates the pleasure center of the male's brain. That's probably true of songbirds singing, you know, to other male songbirds or female songbirds, if that's what turns them on. So let's make sure we're inclusive now of all of our sangha in our community, right? And our trans songbird relatives too. Okay. And so when a male songbird sing to female or male songbirds, it activates the pleasure center of the male's or female's brain. In fact, scientists have discovered that the effects of singing on the bird's brain is similar to the effect of addictive drugs on human brains. So that's kind of interesting. So you can sing and get like, you know, you can get a little hit, like if you visit one of our newly established pot shops or something. But there's a caveat. The effect doesn't happen when the birds are singing alone. As it turns out, singing's effect on humans has a similar caveat. So it's always really sweet to sing with a friend. So if there's anybody in your environment, someone you work with, someone you're at home with, and something comes on the radio, it's really wonderful just to start dancing and singing. And he recommends that if singing isn't our creative expression, we could also bring in whatever our other creative expression is, like drawing, playing an instrument, or dancing. So in addition to meditating and singing, moving our body, walking, exercise, yoga, of course we know also has a very positive effect on our mental state and can be the source of joy. One of the things that we're going to be exploring is how to be aware of when we do have positive mental factors. And one way we can do that is actually to keep a little journal. I actually bought these sweet little moleskin writing pads at the university bookstore because I'm listening to a new teacher on Dharma Seed. You want to hear some gossip about the who hot teacher is? Rob Burbia, B-U-R-B-E-A. He has a new book out called Seeing That Frees. How to actually practice in meditation and incline the mind towards insight. It's really interesting. And I've actually been listening to him in my car, and I brought a little pad because he says some pretty interesting things. So I'm journaling on what really hits me. Burbea, he's got 400 talks on Dharma Seed. So keep a journal. So I've started to do that. It makes me happy. And then one thing that we also should do right now is a lot of us, some people might have a negative attitude towards happiness and joy. You know, it's not necessarily true that we all think that That is a natural aspect of awakening or moving towards awakening. In fact, can I share what you told me? Actually, Aaron came up and he said, you know, there's a lot, you know, what he expressed, I'll kind of paraphrase, is that, you know, part of our path, you know, we know is opening to the suffering, right? Opening to the first noble truth, to the truth of dukkha, to the truth of suffering in our lives. And, you know, we know that the first noble truth has a verb associated with it, right? Each of the four noble truths has a verb, something we're supposed to do with it. And what, you know, the first noble truth, which is the truth of unsatisfactoriness or suffering, what's the verb associated with it? Dukkha is to be known, right? I was talking to, is Elizabeth Lynn here? I was talking to Elizabeth Lynn, who teaches mindfulness for the University of Washington. She's this wonderful primary care physician. And she was talking about teaching mindfulness, you know, an 8-course series. And she said, they found out that by the 5th course, nobody was coming back after the 5th class, because that's when people started to see all of the dukkha in their lives. Is that true? Did anybody experience that? It's like, wow. You know, it really opens us up to what's happening in there. And, you know, at the university, some of the people are now only teaching it up to the 5th class. And, you know, that's really true, but, you know, I want to read actually this other testimonial to what's possible. Here it is. This is Nancy Kuglin. I have received a gift that is beyond words. I've witnessed my deepest despair, the darkest, most wounded quarters of my heart, and learned not to flinch or back away. I rested in love and even tasted joy, all the while still knowing the sorrow of my loss. A few days ago, I held a bereaved mother in my arms as she sobbed. She had lost her son to suicide. I held her to my heart as she held on for dear life. And as I rocked her, it was as if I was rocking Julia, rocking myself, rocking the broken hearts of all beings. And in that rocking, in that holding, we were held in one heart. I have been so blessed. You know, that's, I think, what the promise of this practice is to know that there's a huge amount of resiliency there, a huge amount of courage if we, you know, trust that we can open to it and hold it. And it, I actually got engaged recently. That was joyful. But, you know, my fiance actually had 2 bouts of pretty bad cancer. And, oh my gosh, you know, when I opened to that, I just felt like I had joined an exquisite new club. And I'm sure that many of you in this room or in that club, you've either had cancer or had loved ones and saw someone through a bout of cancer, right? And it's like, it is such one mark of our common humanity, you know, that we all have these bodies. When we have these bodies, that's what's in store for all of us at some point. You know, we're either in the front of the line or the back of the line, but we are all in line. And, you know, that's one way that we could come to just open to each other's suffering and to our own, is to realize that it's not personal. You know, that's one of actually the aspects of anatta, of not self, that none of it is personal. Being a human is like this. So So that's another one of the foundational principles in Buddhism that I wanted to talk about the, you know, given that the first noble truth is the needs to be known, that we need to open to these common elements of humanity, then how is it? Where is the joy in this? Where is the joy? And actually, there's two things that I want to talk about. First, I want to give you the definition of this very common, you know, just like all of those positive mental qualities like joy and forgiveness and gratitude. And there's another one, it's actually called Samvega. It means spiritual urgency. It's translated as spiritual urgency, Samvega. And here's a definition of it. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that comes with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it is normally lived. A chastening sense of one's own complacency and foolishness in having let oneself live so blindly, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Like, what is going on here? But, you know, there's actually a sense of, there's some wisdom in that. There's some wisdom in realizing that all of the things that we're taught by the television commercials and everyone trying to sell us, you know, an advanced capitalist society, you know, all of the things that people believe will make them happy, to realize the futility of that and to realize the lack of inherent joy in that, you know, that's wisdom. And it could bring a sense of, wow, what is it all about, of futility of life. But what it does is it actually turns us towards to look for those things where real joy is possible, and things that will bring us a sense of authentic satisfaction. And those are those very positive mental states, generosity, you know, understanding our interconnectedness, understanding that we are in this together. And, you know, all of those positive qualities that we are training our mind in right now. And, you know, what this course does, it asks us to actually feel and, you know, with our mindfulness to extract the wisdom out of the positive uplift in our mind and our heart when we have developed those, you know, those qualities and as we develop them. You know, it's a very positive message. And another thing that, you know, so James was coaching me this morning. I love that. He's so great. He's actually offered to coach me during this whole series about what I should be talking about. James, I'm counting on you. He actually offered to Zoom in via Skype and to co-lead these discussions. We're working on it, right? I don't know if we're going to be able to, but he offered that. He's so kind and generous. He's such a wonderful person. But the other thing he said was, what you need to talk about, Bonnie, is two things. You need to talk about Samvega, about, you know, opening to, you know, essentially the three characteristics of experience. To know that the things that we really think are going to bring us lasting satisfaction that we spend so much of our time doing really are not going to bring us, you know, the satisfaction that we want. So we want to extract the wisdom out of that. For example, is Ellen here? Ellen and I went shopping on Saturday to the penny sale. And, you know, after like an hour, we were just like trudging around, like, where's the happiness here? Couldn't find the happiness. But that was a good sign that we were disenchanted by the pennies, you know, before 1 o'clock sale. We were done. And then, you know, James also wanted me to talk about some translations of, you know, we also read a lot about, particularly in the nuns and monks training, you know, historically Asian monks and nuns have been taught about just the vileness and disgusting nature of the human body. And, you know, we often might carry that out and think, you know, well, is there really any joy? You know, can we have joy because everything is so disgusting? And you know, the nature of the human body, we as humans are somehow inherently disgusting. What I'm trying to say is that's one of the messages that we might get from Buddhism, right? I mean, we might get that message or not understand really what that means. And Andrew Alinsky, who, you know, is the founder of BCBS, Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, you know, has translated that disgust to something much more akin to just disenchantment. You know, that's what it is. It's not really it's disgusting. Though you can feel that, you know, that would be not an illegitimate way to feel. But really what the term is disenchantment. Really extracting the wisdom out that there is, you know, a sense of dissatisfaction with any conditioned thing. And, you know, that's the teaching. All conditioned things are inherently unsatisfactory. And this is what Ajahn Sumedho, who, you know, we know as one of the senior Western Buddhist monks, says about joy. Sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, we get the impression that you shouldn't enjoy beauty. If you see a beautiful flower, you should contemplate its decay. Or if you see a beautiful woman, you should contemplate her as a rotting corpse. This has a certain value on one level, but it's not a fixed position to take. It's not what we should just feel compelled. It's not that we should just feel compelled to reject beauty and dwell on its impermanence and how it changes to being not so beautiful and then downright repulsive. That's a good reflection on anicca, dukkha, and anatta, but it can leave the impression that beauty is only to be reflected on in terms of these three characteristics, rather than in terms of the experience of beauty. This is the joy of mudita, being able to appreciate the beauty of things around us. People who can't see the beauty of the good or the true are really bitter and mean. They live in an ugly realm where there is no rejoicing in beauty and goodness and truth. Once one has insight, then enjoys and delights in the beauty and the goodness of things. Truth, beauty, and goodness delight us. In them we find joy. This is mudita. So I think, you know, if we really do think that, you know, we can't reflect on the beauty of our lives, that's a misinterpretation of the Buddhist teachings. So I've got like 12 more pages and we're running out of time. So here's one more by Lama Gundin Rinpoche. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but it is already there in relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do. Whatever arises in the mind has no reality whatsoever. Don't become attached to it. Don't pass judgment. Let the game happen on its own. Springing up and falling back without changing anything, and all will vanish and reappear without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It is like a rainbow which you can run after without ever catching. Although it does not exist, it has always been there and accompanies you every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They are like rainbows. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax this grasping, space is there open and inviting and comfortable. So make use of it. All is yours already. Don't search any further. Don't go into the inextricable jungle looking for the elephant who is quietly at home. Nothing to do, nothing to force, and everything happens by itself. So joy. So one of my friends, Vinny Ferraro, many of you might know him, after something like that, he says, "What did you hear? What did you hear?" Any questions, comments? There's some very deep practitioners in this sangha. I love them. Any words of wisdom on this topic or questions or comments? Speak up so we can all hear.
I was, I'm in between jobs, in between houses.
Wow.
In between all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mind is just like so easily falls into this, well, I should this, but what if that, and if only, and you know, this whole thing. And I have had two or three nights of just unpleasant. And this morning I woke up and I said, and it just occurred to me, why am I believing all these thoughts? And instantly I was relaxed and a smile came to my face.
Wow.
And it was like, now, you know, just like everything else, that doesn't last all that long.
Right.
But at least it was like a reminder of how close it is.
That is so beautiful. That's a wonderful description. Did everybody hear that? That's a wonderful description of it was wisdom that let go of those things, right? Because that was wisdom that arose, like, why am I believing this? And all of a sudden, wisdom let it go. That was a beautiful example of that.
I was letting go of the, I can figure out the right thing.
Right. Well, were you letting it go, or did wisdom let it go?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. It was this letting go of this idea that I could think my way into a place of relaxation.
Right, that's interesting. Yeah, conceptual mind, boy, it'll take us there. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And you're looking for a job too, right? Anyway. Any other words of wisdom? Dennis?
You know, what I heard and what I hold in this area that seems to grow with some kind of deeper richness for me is this ability of the mind to hold opposites. That you can sense this immense gratitude for just to be alive, to have this opportunity to grow that I almost would have a hard time describing to someone in kind of logical world words, that it's just life is just infused with this magic that has a joy to it, and it's suffering, and people that I'm close to are hurting, and you know, things that I wish are happening that I wish in my heart weren't, and I try to do my best to. So, you know, these are two simultaneously. It's like the pain and the joy really kind of reside with each other in there, and I didn't think that's not the way that I was taught to see the world, or you know, the practice has kind of opened me up to a mind that can hold those two things at once.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's like that poem about the woman who was rocking her friend, who, you know, her son committed suicide. It's like, there's such a tenderness of heart there. You can feel the interconnectedness, you know, and there's so much love in there and so much, you know, sense of belonging, while just the most horrific things might be happening. It is, the two opposite things are often true at the same time. And there is something about, you know, practicing a lot with happiness and joy. Actually, that's an interesting question about what's the difference between happiness and joy. Actually, in Abhidhamma, happiness is like an adjective and joy is a noun. That's interesting, right? Joy is like an emotion or a mental state, and happiness is like an adjective. It's associated with positive vedana, positive, you know, pleasant sensation. But joy is something much more substantial. Okay, one last thing that I want to make sure is on the tape so James can hear it. Is one thing he says that I just think is really brilliant. He says, don't go for the gush. You know, and that means, you know, we are in a society of such extremes, right? We don't want to just be happy or joyful. We want ecstatic happiness, right? I mean, if it's not incredibly strong, you know, we might not even think about the usefulness of it. There is actually one little quote about that I wanted to read, that we don't need to be so excessive that we're in ecstasy. You know, we can be happy with just feeling a slight sense of happiness. That's absolutely fine, and that's enough for us to reflect on. You know, the other thing about that is you really want to know when you have those positive qualities in yourself or you see those positive qualities in others. You know, it's actually absolutely part of right effort, right? It's part of the Eightfold Path. It's one of the path factors, right effort. And you know, we can do that even with the slightest sense of well-being, that we should know that that's in our mind. We don't have to go for the gush. Well, this is actually a little story about that sense of samvega, or that sense of disenchantment. I read you, and I like the story about the dog. A dog stumbles across a bone that has been exposed to the elements for many months and has been therefore bleached of any residual flesh or marrow. The dog gnaws on it for some time before he finally determines that he is not finding any satisfaction in the bone, and he thus turns away from it in disgust. It is not that the bone is intrinsically disgusting, it's rather the case that the dog's raging desire for meat just will not be satisfied by the bone. He is enchanted by the prospect of gratification as he scraps away furiously at the bone, but when he finally wakes up to the truth that the bone is empty of anything that will offer him satisfaction, he becomes disenchanted and spits it out in disgust. So that's what we're really, you know, that's what we want to do. You know, we don't want to try to give up any of these things that might, you know, be, you know, habit patterns in our lives that aren't working. You know, we can try to give them up. But what we really want to do is just extract the wisdom, the truth of it, out of the experience with our mindfulness, and then the wisdom arises, just as you talked about it. The wisdom arises and lets it go. You know, we don't have to try to actually give it up. In fact, James sent me another little piece about the difference between setting a goal through willpower and setting a goal through investigation. You know, investigation is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's an incredibly positive mental factor that we always want to promote and build up. And he says that the neuroscience says, that having an investigative approach to something we want to do, like losing weight or exercising more or anything, having an investigative approach, like, you know, what will it take for me to actually make this more routine in my life, is a much more successful attitude than saying, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to do it and, you know, applying willpower to it. So just really investigating. So, you know, I'll invite us all to investigate the question, what would it take for me to invite more joy into my life? What will it take for me to notice the joy and the positive qualities in others and myself? What will it take? Any other questions or comments? So I do, you know, I do want to point out the book to you, Awakening Joy, 10 Steps to Happiness. And I am going to also say that there is a app that you can get at the iTunes store. It's only $6. It's called Awakening Joy. And it actually sends you little messages on your phone many times a day, like, you know, it reminds us to just be aware of the happiness and gives us little, inclines our mind towards positive qualities. So you might want to investigate the Awakening Joy app. But you don't, you know, totally, it's not, if you don't have $6, please don't feel like I'm, you know, really promoting that. Any other final questions or comments?
What's our homework?
Oh my gosh, there's so much homework. Thank you. Okay, the homework, you're absolutely right. Thank you, Diane Hedrick, about reminding about the homework. Okay, homework. This exercise comes from We Choose to Be Happy by, there's a book called We Choose to Be Happy. And it's called Create a Nourishment List. Just write down things that make you happy. It could be the simplest things like eating a peach or something exotic like windsurfing or anything in between, walking your dog, listening to music. And then, you know, once you develop your list, check the items that you do regularly in your life. What are those easy things to do that you have, you know, whether you've included in your life or not? And then circle the items that are realistic to include more in your life these days. Choose three items from the list that you will focus on during the week. And not in the spirit of I will, but in the spirit of how can I do this? The second one is notice well-being when it's here. Pay attention to when you're feeling good. Notice a wholesome state of joy when it arises. Notice with interest how it feels in your body and your mind. Experience the gladness of the wholesome. Yeah, they actually have an uplifting quality on your heart. Just notice how uplifting they are. You know, after James sent me all this stuff this morning and that letter to read to you, I, you know, immediately took the good advice and I wrote back and I said, I'm just thinking right now about how joyful all of these things that you sent me, the joy that it's evoking in me right now. You know, just to really acknowledge and just to, you know, I said, I'm so grateful for you right now. Are we grateful for James? Let's tell him. Yeah. We're grateful for you. Yay, James. Let's reflect on his goodness. We can reflect on his goodness right now. Okay, so that's investigate the good. Notice when you're happy. Give yourself reminders to set your intention often during the day. You know, again, allow yourself to see joy. Ask someone to be your joy buddy. You know, ask someone to check in with you about joy. And then, you know, finally, when you're feeling sad, totally open to your sadness as well. And, you know, with some trust that, you know, awareness has, that's one of the qualities of awareness itself. It actually has a huge amount of resiliency in it. You know, awareness without fear floating through it says bring it. It really can hold whatever. It can hold all of it. Is that enough?